Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. I do want to share with you some science behind why people see ghosts and demons. Now, this is what some people are saying, and I have a few thoughts that go a little bit beyond what they're saying, but this is from, take this with a grain of salt, okay, it's from the Daily Beast. Articles called The Science Behind Why People See Ghosts and Demons. I'll just give you a few of the salient points. They talk about how skeptical scholars from the field of neuroscience and cognitive psychology have been trying to show that this belief in seeing extraordinary phenomena like ghosts or demons, they're trying to show that it's more about how people process reality subjectively in their brain. Some people, the article says, might just be wired to produce these experiences in their mind, even though they may not be real. While you might assume that parapsychology revolves around Ghostbusters, spoon bending, and levitating magicians, Uri Geller, remember him? Uri Geller, he would pop up on the Mike Douglas show and the Dinah Shore show, those daytime talk shows, and he would give his, he would bend spoons with his mind, or it appeared to be that kind of thing. So that's the kind of thing they're talking about. And they say that parapsychology is an academic branch of psychology that's studied in universities and research facilities around the globe. Scientists in this field believe more academic, experimental, theoretical, and analytical research will show that what science knows about the nature of the universe is largely incomplete. And one of the people cited in this particular article, this is Brian Laith. He's the director of the Institute for the Study of Religious and Anomalous Experience. He's a member of the Parapsychological Association. He said, where people fight over is the meaning and interpretation of these findings, which in bulk are theology and philosophy driven as opposed to issues of analytical science. He says, we need parapsychology because if there were telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, precognition, ghosts, or any of these things, then science has to be radically overthrown. And that's a quote there from Susan Blackmore. She's also a psychology professor at the University of Plymouth. And she's a skeptic of these things. She says, I'm glad there are other people doing this. And then, of course, I'm not terribly surprised. They don't find any reliable findings. They don't have any theory that works. They don't have any findings that contribute to any kind of theoretical progress. So they're just asking the same questions. And in this study that is cited here, it refers to how a lab focused on cognitive differences that the scientist who's cited here, Michael van Elk, he's a professor of cognitive psychology in the Netherlands, he believes that these differences are the basis for why people believe and experience the paranormal. According to his research, paranormal believers are more inclined to trust their intuition and emotions and are less guided by analytical reflection. They appear to perceive more illusory agents in random motion displays, meaning that they might have a basis or a bias rather for seeing shapes and objects where there aren't ones. And we talked a little bit about this yesterday, I think, where you look up in the sky and you see a cloud and it looks like a bear or it looks like a face or something like that. That's the natural human capacity or tendency to try to impose meaning on purely random things like clouds and other things. This is where you've seen the stories about people, they see an image of the Blessed Virgin Mary on a piece of toast or something like that. And I grant you, I mean, you can look at some of these things and immediately say, yeah, that looks like sort of an outline of Mary, or it looks like the outline of Jesus, or it looks like the shape of a person or something. So this is not unique to a certain kind of person. But what they're saying is that it seems to be more common in people who trust more in their instincts and in their, you know, their intuitions as opposed to being analytical. Now, this is where I diverge from what I'm seeing here. First of all, I would argue that it may well be that a great deal of what these paranormal phenomena are purely from the imagination. Sometimes somebody will call up and I'll say, and they'll say, well, I think God spoke to me, or I got a revelation, or something happened, or I feel as though someone's communicating with me from the beyond. And my default position is to assume that more often than not, it's just your own imagination, because we human beings are very powerful in our imaginations. And there's a great deal that might seem extraordinary or mystical to us. It's really just coming from us, coming from you, from your inner emotions, your memories, and things like that. It doesn't mean that it couldn't be extra, you know, extraordinary in the sense that it would be from the supernatural realm. That's entirely possible. It could be demonic, could be angelic in the good sense, could be from God, could be from someone in purgatory who's asking you for prayer. I mean, I've got a million and one stories of things that either have happened to me or have happened to people that I know. And so just anecdotally, I'm aware that these kinds of things abound. And if we open the phone lines, which we're not going to do, the phone lines are open, by the way, but it's not going to be the story hour where everybody tells the story about the guardian angel that they saw, because that can be endless. Everybody's got stories like this. And to greater or lesser extents, people have things that to them seem as though they may be supernatural. But in any case, where I am a little bit... where I would draw the line is that ultimately it seems to me that this process, especially when you have people who are skeptical in the first place, if it's coming from an atheistic worldview, it would tend to, in my estimation of looking at these things, it would tend to try to reduce everything to brain chemistry. In other words, if you can explain away paranormal experiences, if you can explain away visions or precognitive dreams or other phenomena that are beyond the ability of science to explain, well, ultimately, if you have a sort of meta explanation for everything, and some people do go in this direction, that's to say, well, there really is no supernatural realm. There is nothing spiritual per se. You don't really have a soul. You're not going anywhere when you die. There is no heaven. There are no gods. There are no angels. None of that stuff really exists. What that really amounts to is simply your brain chemistry. And certain people whose brains are wired a certain way and who are more analytical, they will say, are less likely to have these notions of these visions or supernatural entities appearing to them, that kind of thing. And people who are more in the direction of their emotions, and of course your brain chemistry can tell us a whole lot about your emotions, you're just one of those kind of people. And so what you think of as gods or God or an angel or a devil or a soul or the afterlife, all that really is just your brain chemistry. So that's not stated in this article in the Daily Beast. It's not thematized in this article. But as you read it with, you know, that in mind. And I think what you'll see is it's sort of a subtext to the whole thing. It's a subtle way of saying that what all these people think about religion and these other, you know, immaterial events and phenomena, all that really ultimately is, and science will eventually get around to proving this, it's just your brain chemistry, that's all. So if you have been flirting with atheism, or maybe you care about somebody who is an atheist, this could be a helpful article to you, because as you read it and think about it, you'll see a little more clearly into the mindset that takes science as a way of approaching what I would regard to be, in the case of actual supernatural events or actual supernatural realities like God and angels and human souls, etc., and to try to apply this scientific approach to it to basically debunk it and to say, well, that's just the way your brain chemistry works. That's all it is, nothing more. Now, one way you can turn that around is to say, well, okay, fair enough. I don't believe that. I don't agree with that. But let's take it a little bit further. Let's go beyond notions of leprechauns and angels and gods and things like that. Let's go to something a little more concrete that we deal with every day. What about things like your memories? Are your memories real, or are they just the electrically charged chemical reactions fizzing away in your brain matter? Is human dignity real? Human rights, is that real? Is it a thing? It clearly is not a physical thing, nor is love. It's not a physical thing. You can't get to it someplace. You can't mine it out of the ground or go get a box of it at Lowe's. You can't get it that way, but it's still real, right? Love is real. You love your wife. You love your kids. That's real, isn't it? That's what I would ask the atheist. Isn't that real? Because if it's not real, then this whole life that we think we're living is nothing more than just pure nature. But we all know that love is real. We all know that things like that are immaterial realities. And I come back to this topic fairly frequently because it warrants it, and that is, what about the idea of truth itself? What about truth? Is truth real? Is there such a thing as truth? Well, it's self-evidently, obviously true. Yes, there is. And even just making that statement, that's a truth claim. We can't even make any truth claims. If somebody said, no, that's not true, that's a truth claim. So in order for someone to negate that, he would have to assert that something is true or not true, and that just simply proves the point. You see what I'm saying? So perhaps in your deliberations on this or in conversations with people who don't hold the view that God exists, you can maybe go down that pathway and ask them questions. Well, then what do you mean if the only things that really exist are purely material, if it's just the natural order, if that's all there really is, and who cares how many millions or zillions of different universes there are? It just begs the question. It doesn't solve the problem. It just expands the data set a little bit further out. That's all. But if that's all that exists, and there is nothing beyond nature, which we call the supernatural realm, then how do you account for truth? What is it? Where is it? It's not material. And it's there whether people realize it's there or not. People who are ignorant of the truth don't suddenly make truth vanish. The fact that 2 + 2 = 4 is not known by some people doesn't mean that because they don't know it, therefore the truth that 2 + 2 = 4 doesn't exist. Obviously, truth remains regardless of if even nobody knew the truth. It's still true, and we have yet to discover it. So anyway, check it out. See if that article strikes a chord with you. I think it's helpful. And I encourage people to do what I do, and that is to avail yourself of viewpoints that are inconsistent with your own so that you can learn how to dialogue with people. And you'll be in a much better position to evaluate truth claims. That's what I think. Anyway, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Valerie in Reedsburg, Wisconsin. Hello, Valerie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a comment on the dad that called with that 16-year-old girl, and I just wanted to share a little bit of maybe a different side of that. I guess I don't agree that it's – I agree that it's not morally wrong, but I still don't think it's right to take oral contraception just because there are so many other – more healthy ways to go about this issue.
Mm-hmm. Who are you disagreeing with? Because that's the position that I hold.
I guess maybe I didn't hear the whole thing, but I
okay.
Because I got to work, but I heard you say that those PhDs says it's not morally wrong to take this drug, but I just wanted to warn on the infertility, the cancer, the depression risk of doing that.
And well, that is probably part of the show that you didn't hear, Valerie. And that, fair enough.
Okay,
that happens.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. But I want to support what you're saying, because after that, I think I went to a break, but then I came back and I read a lengthy section from a website that's onemoresoul.com, and getting into the harms that are readily apparent with things like the abortifacient pill, and just shared about cancer and the correlation between taking the pill and breast cancer and things like that. So I very much share your view. The point I was trying to make was that from a moral standpoint, would it be immoral for a 13-year-old girl, 16-year-old girl, I think it was, to take the pill, not for sexual reasons, but to clear up a health problem? And that was the question the father had asked. So I was saying, morally, no, it's not a problem if it's legitimately prescribed, etc. But then I pivoted into, but here are all the problems, health problems, problems with these hormones and what they do, which sounds to me like what you're underscoring. Is that right?
Right. I struggle with infertility myself, and I have to wonder all of these things that, like, you know, I wish somebody had told me these things about the birth control pill. I remember hearing from my sister, who was a public health major, she told me that, you know, it lowers your cancer risk, which is absolutely false. But, you know, the world wants to tell you to take that, because it goes against family. And, you know, the other thing is I think that in a 16-year-old girl's mind, taking birth control, you know, green lighted by mom and dad, can also just be a way to secretly do things that she ought not to be doing. Mm-hmm. Even though the starting reason was for health reasons, not
right.
conception reasons. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. That's the slippery slope argument.
Dark.
You know, if she realizes, oh gee, well, I'm not sexually active now, but if I were, I wouldn't get pregnant, she might think.
Yeah.
And that could
I wouldn't have to have a conversation with mom and dad, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know what's interesting? And I touched on this earlier. This is on the website. In fact, it's posted on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. If you look in the lower right corner, you'll see where the Twitter feed is embedded, and you can click on the link there. I think you'll find it fascinating. To your point about the reduction in the likelihood of cancer, this article points out that whereas the pill does seem to lower a woman's likelihood of getting uterine cancer and cervical cancer, there seems to be some medical truth to that claim, it greatly increases the risk of breast cancer by 44%, according to the meta study that was done by the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, or it was published there anyway. So I have a feeling, Valerie, that maybe when they're telling young women, well, this will lower your likelihood of getting cancer, they may be referring only to those cancers, but they don't tell the honest truth about the significant increase in the likelihood of breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One other thing is, you know, like just natural family planning doctors are out there, and perhaps she's got endometriosis that could be helped by those good folks. I've seen so many of them. I don't have that issue, but I know that there's other alternatives. So I just, you know, keep seeking, and I think that girl will fare better. So anyway, I didn't mean to disagree
no,
with
it's
you
fine.
Because I didn't hear all of the things that you said, but I appreciate your show. Thank you.
Thanks, Valerie. Thank you. And thanks for giving me a chance to further clarify, because this is important stuff. Now, for women who are wondering about this very issue, I would say get in touch with the Vitae Clinic. They're in Austin, Texas. Vitae, which is Latin for of life, V-I-T-A-E, Vitae Clinic, obstetrics and gynecology. They're associated with the John Paul II Life Center, which is also in Austin, Texas, and they help treat infertility. They also provide other services for women, but it's 100% pro-life, staffed by doctors and medical professionals. They know what they're doing, and they have a very high success rate, especially for women who are suffering with infertility. They have a very high success rate in helping women not only conceive, but also to bring babies to term. Sometimes there's not a problem with conception, but there's a problem with carrying the baby to term. And women who lose children through miscarriage are suffering greatly, as their husbands are as well. So they have telemedicine available. They have testimonials on their website. It's all very interesting and very helpful. And I know the people involved, so I can assure you from my own personal experience that they are really helpful in what they do. So their website is vitaeaustin.com, V-I-T-A-E, Austin, all one word, V-I-T-A-E, Austin.com. And I think you'll find what they have there to be very helpful, especially if you're looking for resources in that area. We're going to take a break, as you can tell, and we'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. When we come back, I want to share with you a fascinating analysis of how it is that when you live in a culture that's based on lies, kind of like the one we're in right now, how do they get people to go along with the lies? I'm going to explain to you exactly how they do that right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
All right, listen to this. This is a book. It's called We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. And the author is Kai Strittmatter, Strittmatter. A lot of T's in that name. In the whole book, it's how many pages? It's like 360 pages. And it's a fascinating, I'm trying to put into words my reaction to reading this book. It's a fascinating and terrifying analysis of the mind control that is being brought to bear on the average Chinese citizen in China on a moment-to-moment basis. How do they do this is the question that underlies the book. Now, I'm going to read to you a section from the book, and if you find this that it rings true, what I'm asking you to do is consider what Kai Strittmatter says about what's going on in China. And by the way, Kai Strittmatter lives in China, lives in Beijing. So this is not like some dude talking about this from some other location, but you know, someone who lives in this world. But I'd like you to think about this in terms of things going on here in this world, the world that you live in, the world where Mattel is rolling out a transgender Barbie doll, and everybody is either hailing this as a feat of progress or they're keeping their mouths closed for fear that the Twitter mob will come after them and punish them if they speak out against it. What's going on in the libraries with the drag queen story hours? Outrageously offensive. The kind of thing that should get people thrown in jail and under different circumstances would get people thrown in jail. The ideologies that are being drummed into the kids' heads from pre-K until they graduate from college all across the world, all across this country in any case, gender ideology, critical race theory, and all the other things that are being pumped into the minds of these people. And then you may say, well, why does nobody say anything about this? Why does nobody do anything about this? Some people are, of course, but how come there aren't sufficient numbers of people, like, you know, the adults who are responsible and attentive to taking care of kids and shielding them from problems and things like that? How come, where are they? How come they're not standing up and saying something? Now, the honest truth is some people are, and thank God for that. But why is it that the steamroller effect has just leveled in this country, and you know it has just leveled what once was a kind of bulwark against insanity. Doesn't mean the country was perfect. Wasn't perfect. Never has been. We've had a lot of problems. Racism. We could go on down the list. We don't need to, but you get the idea. In other words, why is it that these aberrations, especially these sexual aberrations, why are they permitted? Why are they tolerated? Why are they even here now? Why didn't somebody early on stand up and say, no, we're not going to do that? Listen to this. This is from the book, We Have Been Harmonized. I think this explains what's going on here. China's ruling party insists to this day that its country is communist. And if it is once again forcing teachers, professors, civil servants, and businessmen to make public commitments to Marxism, it's not because it takes, it's not because it seriously thinks the population still believes in Marx. In the Swiss legend of William Tell, all the peasants were forced to salute a hat placed on a post by the imperial governor. Marxism is China's version of this hat. It is the gesture of submission that matters. This is how the autocrat deploys his lies. By refusing to swallow them, Marx you out as an enemy and a target. But intimidation is only half the story. It's just as important to sow confusion, to disrupt rationality and reality that give people a frame of reference, to take the compass away from the nation and the world. If you're a liar and a cheat, there's no way for you to win in a world that is repelled by these things, a world that differentiates between truth and lies. So you have to make everyone else a liar and a cheat too. Then you will at least be their liar. Hannah Arendt, who studied totalitarian regimes, said as much in an interview in 1974. If everyone always lies to you, the consequence is not that you believe the lies. Please listen closely to this. Listen closely to what she's saying here. If everyone always lies to you, the consequence is not that you believe the lies, but rather that nobody believes anything any longer. But a population that no longer believes anything is robbed of its ability to think and to judge, and ultimately its capacity to act. As Arendt says, with such a people, you can do what you please. These are the ideal subjects, or the ideal opponents. The mirror image of the liar's shamelessness is the shame of the person being lied to. That's you, by the way. At least while you remain aware of the nonsense that you yourself are bolstering every day in chorus with everyone else. The act of repeating obvious untruths binds you to the liar with a rope of complicity. In the end, the ruler's lies breed cynicism among the people being ruled, who make their peace with the powerlessness of their situation and ultimately cling to just one thing, the leader's power. At that point, the leader no longer has to account for anything because there is no truth left outside his fabrications. In a world where the distinction between truth and lies has been abolished, there are just facts and alternative. The dominant values are not morality and a sense of responsibility, but usefulness and profit. If you do see the truth, it will do you no good to tell it. In fact, it's dangerous. Best of all is to acknowledge the lie as true and embrace it passionately. That's what the fanatics do. But they will only ever be a very small group. The next best thing is deliberately to avoid learning the truth, to live a life of benumbed ignorance. And if you do happen upon the truth, keep quiet and pretend you haven't. These two groups represent the majority of the population. Anyone who speaks the truth is either stupid or suicidal. The smart people in such a world are not the clear-sighted and wise. The smart people are the cunning and shrewd. There's no room here for common sense, or rather, ignorance is the new common sense, necessary for survival or used to justify opportunistic advancement. That right there is the truth. And although I've never set foot in China, I can easily imagine that that's exactly what's going on in China. It explains a lot, doesn't it? But I am a citizen of the United States of America, and I can tell you, and I don't need to tell you because you can tell it to yourself, that that right there is a way of explaining why we're in the situation we're in. Because people realize if you stick your head up on Twitter or on Facebook or at the PTA meeting, or you talk to your kid's teacher at school or in some other setting and you say, drag queen story hour is wrong and I don't want that, you know that you will be punished for that. And so more and more as things go, the cement is hardening. That's the analogy that comes to my mind. The cement is hardening, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for the average person, just like you, to say anything about it, because you know if you do, you're going to pay a heavy price. So what do most people do? They just either ignore it and hope it'll go away, which it won't, or they just buckle under the weight of negative peer pressure and they go along with it. They go along to get along. And then, of course, you have the people at the further end of the spectrum who are gung-ho about it because they realize that there are some social advantages if you become one of them. If you become a fanatic in these areas and you're promoting these things and you're flouting these things, or touting rather, not flouting, you're touting these things, there are benefits that will accrue to you if you do that. There are pay raises and money for research that'll be poured into your work. There'll be positions of advancement. You want to move up in this company? Well, where's your gay pride label? Where's your gay pride flag? If you don't have a gay pride flag, you're probably not going to move up in this company. Chances are you might even not be working here a year from now because you're one of those people. You're one of those uppity people who won't go along with the program. And those messages can be given very explicitly or very implicitly, but they're there. And you feel them and you see them. And your kids are experiencing them in school. It's everywhere now. So my advice, if you want more of the same, check out the book. I have no connection to this person. I do not know the person who wrote this book. But when I was reading it, I thought this explains a lot. And it was put in very clear terms that I think anyone can benefit from. We'll get a link to the book. Online, I guess. You sound just like Rick Moranis today, Cyrus.
I don't want to hear this.
It's called We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. And if you look it up, you'll find it. Who published this book? It's published by, where is it? Who's published it? I can't even see. Published by Old Street Publishing in England. So there it is. 888-914-9149. Now, if you didn't hear the whole soliloquy that I just gave you, you can always listen to any part of this program. About an hour after the show is over, we post the archive copy, and you can find it there. And if you want to share it with somebody, you'll find it there. I would encourage you to share that. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Lewis in Lodi, New Jersey. Hi, Lewis.
Good morning, Patrick. Let me start off by saying I love your show. I've been listening to it for a while now.
And thank you.
I really probably couldn't do without it.
Thank you. I'm happy to hear that.
I want to just make a comment. Oh, thank you. I just want to make a comment, and plus I have a question for you after the comment. Now, yesterday someone called and says if you're with the same sex any length of time, you will become attracted to them. Some, in those words, that's what I'm saying.
I remember that call. That call stands out in my memory.
I agree with you 100%. That's totally ridiculous because throughout my whole life, and I just turned 77 Saturday, my best friend was a homosexual. We never had any contact whatsoever other than the enjoyment of being together. Mm-hmm. And we were together like brothers. And we shared our lives together. Never once did we ever have an attraction. And I just feel that maybe I had to call in to say that whatever he was saying was bogus. It was just not, it was not true. Okay.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. For those who didn't hear it, the gentleman who called in was saying that it's a fact. I'm paraphrasing, but I mean, anyone can go back and listen to the call yesterday and they'll hear exactly in his own words. But he was saying, in essence, everybody is in some way at some time attracted to the same sex. And I butted in. I said, well, not me. I've never been attracted to the same sex. And I think he tried to say, well, you're being very defensive about it, as if that somehow suggested, you know, like a hidden homosexual attraction. But in any case, I just denied the premise. I said, I don't believe that. There are plenty of people. You're another one of us, Lewis, who just don't experience same-sex attraction. And he kept bringing up Brad Pitt for some reason.
Right.
Remember that part of the call, Brad Pitt?
I do. I remember the whole call because it was very, it was very sensitive to me because of my relationship with my best friend.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many people could say going through their life they had a best friend. I mean, we were on baseball teams together. We worked together. We were haircutters together.
But did your friend look like Brad Pitt, though? That's the real question.
With black hair, yes. He was a good-looking man, and, you know, I don't want to be egotistical, but I don't think, you know, someone would turn away from the way I look either. So it's not something that you would have never had an attraction.
Yeah.
No, you know, it was just something that it didn't take place, and it never came about. It just never came about. So I don't know if anybody else can make a statement like that, but I just felt I had to call, had to. But in the meantime, thank you. That I have a question that I've had to try to call you and ask you about receiving communion. You do have to be in a state of grace, correct?
Right, right.
Is that okay? Now, Protestants, they don't receive communion, but they're capable of being in a state of grace, right?
Not exactly. Let's just put it this way.
Not exactly. Okay.
Let me clarify. If let's say a Protestant, let's say somebody gets baptized in a Protestant church at the age of 20, let's just say. Well, that person is sinless at that moment because of the effects of baptism. Baptism eradicates the condition of original sin. It eliminates not only all sin, but all the effects of sin. So you are pristine in that moment. But like most people, we all tend to fall into sin rather quickly and can fall into serious sin, mortal sin as well. So let's say that somebody is a Protestant, 50 years old, got baptized when he was 20, and 30 years have elapsed. Well, I think I would bet money that that person is not in the state of grace after baptism, because the likelihood of that person falling into at least one mortal sin along the way is quite high. Therefore, to say that a Protestant is in the state of grace objectively is problematic. Now, it doesn't mean that a Protestant couldn't have true contrition for his sins, let's say at the moment of death, and truly be sorry for his sins, and never having gone to sacramental confession, never having the benefit of that, but still is truly sorry for his sins and out of love for God rather than fear of hell. Well, the church says in a situation like that, if somebody is truly sorry, then that would suffice in lieu of sacramental confession. It still leaves the question about, is that person at fault for never becoming Catholic, because the Catholic Church is necessary for salvation? Therefore, what about that? That's a separate question. But no, I wouldn't say that any given Protestant could be said to be in the state of grace if he's lived enough life and had an opportunity to fall into mortal sin for that reason.
I understand. Could I give you the scenario of what I'm leading up to? I went to...
Do me a favor, Lewis. Hold your thought, because I'm overdue for a break. Stand by and we'll do the break, and then we'll come back, and then I'll take your second part of your comment or question right after this. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. You can call 888-914-9149 and be on the air. I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Pure energy.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I just saw the news that the Holy Father, Pope Francis, has accepted the resignation of Bishop Thomas Olmsted of Phoenix, 75 years old. And as you may know, when a bishop turns 75, he has to submit his letter of resignation to the Pope, and the Pope can accept it or not accept it for a period of time. And in this case, he did accept it. And the new bishop of San Diego, the new bishop of Phoenix, is Bishop John Dolan, the auxiliary bishop of San Diego. This I'm reading from the Catholic News Service. So that's happening as of today. And I just found out about it during the break, so I wanted to make you aware of it. 888-914-9149. Let's go back to Lewis in Lodi, New Jersey. Lewis, you had a second part of your question, which was intriguing, but we just didn't have time. So you want to start from there? I think Lewis, I hope Lewis is still there. We saved a spot for you, Lewis.
Uh-oh.
I don't know if Lewis is maybe down the hall making a sandwich, maybe.
Sometimes you put their phone on mute.
No, I'm here. I'm here.
There you are. I didn't have him on mute.
Yes.
Not you.
Okay.
So for some reason, I kept on saying I'm here, but you didn't
okay.
hear me. I don't know why.
There you are. Anyway, okay. All is well.
Yes. Yes, thank you. I went to a funeral a few weeks ago, and before we went up for communion, the priest says only Catholics could come up and receive communion. Now, I was with a couple of people that are beautiful people, wonderful Protestant people that go to church, and I was wondering if it was said a different way, if it was possible to say it a different way, that they may have gone to communion and found a liking to it and came to the church because they did that, and it would have been to where when Christ said, Father, make them one with me as I am one with you, that we could have all been a step closer together. And I kind of felt for them that they couldn't do that, and I know that they would have done it, that they would have received communion. Mm-hmm. And in my eyes, I don't know if they're not worthy of doing that, but in the church's eyes, maybe they're not. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's what came to me about saying, could they be in a state of grace to where they could receive communion?
I get it. Okay, now that makes sense why you asked the question earlier. Well, your perception on this is understandable, but it's not exactly correct, and I'll explain why. The thing to remember is that when you receive Holy Communion as a Catholic, as you know, you're receiving Jesus Christ under the appearances of bread and wine. So he's really, truly, sacramentally, substantially present under the appearances of bread and wine. He's really there. That's why we talk about body, blood, soul, and divinity. It's a term that we Catholics tend to use to kind of explain the real presence of Christ. So it's not just a piece of bread. It's actually Jesus. It's not even not just a piece of bread, it's no longer bread. It has all the characteristics of bread, but it's actually Jesus. So in any case, this is not like a symbolic gesture. It's not like doing something that is showing solidarity with Catholics and, you know, I like you guys. I'm not a Catholic, but I like you guys and I want to be in fellowship with you. So when you have your communion, I'll go up and receive communion as a gesture of goodwill. It's not that at all, and it's never intended to be that. Notice that in John 17, where Jesus says, Father, may they be one as you and I are one, you notice that he doesn't say, Father, they are one as you and I are one. He's not describing the condition of his followers. He's saying that he wants that this should happen. And to have true unity, you can't have true unity if you have a person who is, for whatever reason, remaining outside the church that Christ established, namely the Catholic Church. So it's actually a kind of lie when you think about it, Lewis. If somebody who's not a Catholic at a Catholic Mass receives the Holy Eucharist, he's saying publicly, it's almost like you're in a courtroom and you're swearing an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Even the word sacramentum in Latin, mysterion in Greek, which is translated into Latin as sacramentum, it means an oath. That you are, in essence, swearing an oath before God and before his people. When you say amen, when you receive Holy Communion, you are testifying to a unity that is not real. You're not really in communion with Christ and with his church, even though you may have nice, warm, fuzzy feelings. And I'm not saying this about you personally. I'm just trying to give you a sense of how to look at it. Even though you might have really nice, warm, fuzzy feelings about Catholics and the Catholic Church, when you go into a Catholic Mass and you're not a Catholic and you receive communion, you're essentially, you're committing perjury because you're swearing, you're testifying to something that's not actually real. In St. Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the second half of the chapter, he outlines why this is very spiritually dangerous. He says, if you're not worthy and you do receive the Eucharistic bread and drink the Eucharistic precious blood, he says you're guilty of murder. He says you're guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord if you receive unworthily. That gets to your question about what about somebody who's a Protestant? Could they be in the state of grace? Well, I think objectively speaking, no, they cannot, because since baptism, one can presume that the person has fallen into at least one mortal sin. So that right there, St. Paul says no to. And then the second thing he says in the next breath is, if someone does not discern or recognize the body, he eats and drinks judgment upon himself, damnation. So to look at it from a different perspective, Lewis, I would just tell you what the priest said is right on target, and he was right to do so. Now, maybe he might have done it in a way that came across a little less lovingly than you might prefer, and that's okay. I can understand that. But what he said was correct, because as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, people who receive the Lord in Holy Communion unworthily or without recognizing or discerning the body, they incur serious sins. And he says, this is why some of you are sick and even some of you are dying as a result of this. Now, did he mean that literally? Were there people actually dying because they received communion in the state of mortal sin? Possibly. He doesn't explain it to us beyond that, so we can draw our own conclusions. But at the very least, it was a spiritual kind of illness and death in the case of mortal sin. So rather than watch somebody do something that's spiritually harmful, the church says instead, we would love to welcome you to Holy Communion. We would love for you to be here and to partake of the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. And the way to do that is to become Catholic. Come into the church, and all of these blessings are yours. We're not trying to keep them from you. We want you to have them. Jesus wants you to have them. And our doors are wide open, and everyone is welcome. But it would be seriously wrong to partake of that if you don't believe in it. And if you do believe in it, then become Catholic. So anyway, those are some thoughts. I hope you find that helpful, Lewis. I'm glad we had a chance to talk about this topic. It's important. Thank you. Let's go to Kathy now in Northbrook, Illinois. Hello, Kathy.
Hello, Patrick. I'm calling with regard to the person who wanted to move some of the objectionable materials in the stores. And just to relate a personal thing that happened, one day I decided to talk to the manager of a store where some things I didn't like were displayed. And she was very happy to hear from me because she was on the same page. But she had no people coming up to her, no clients or customers who would say something in the same vein. And once she had someone who said that, she could go to her own supervisor and talk about it. And eventually they did change things.
Awesome.
So.
That's great.
That's the story.
Job well done, Kathy. I could see your point. In other words, she just needed a little extra oomph from somebody that she could then take that customer's complaint to the manager. I'm happy that it worked out that way. Thank you. Well, I'm reminded of a story in my own life. I saw this with my own eyes. There was a kind of a liquor store mini market type of place when I was growing up in Southern California. And it was on the way home from coming home from Mass. And not infrequently, we would stop there as a family after Mass, and my dad would get a box of donuts, and we had donuts on Sunday. That was a big treat for us. And I remember being with my dad when we went into that store, and there was suddenly there what hadn't been there prior to that visit was a magazine rack. And the magazine rack had a lot of porn magazines in it. So my dad lit up. And he not only did he light up, he lit the guy up behind the counter. And he says, you know, I want to talk to the manager. Well, he's in the back. He's busy, right? I want to talk to him right now. So the clerk goes back, gets the manager. The manager's a little bit huffy. And he's, you know, can I help you? And my dad says, the only way you can help me is if you get rid of those porn magazines. So I come in here and I buy donuts and we get other stuff from time to time here. And I don't want that in the store because I come in here, I don't want to see it and I don't want my kids to see it. And I want you to get rid of that stuff. He was just really very forthright with this owner. And the owner got even more huffy. No, you can't tell me what I can sell in my own store. And my dad said, yeah, well, maybe not, but I can tell you that I won't shop here anymore. And the owner's like, as I recall, my memory is that he was like, well, I don't need your money anyway. Like, you're just a drop in the bucket kind of thing. So he was digging his heels and he wasn't going to budge. So my dad said, okay, fine. I'm not coming in here anymore. And I'm going to tell everyone I know not to come in here. Well, what happened was my dad followed through on that. He told everybody, people at our church, people in our neighborhood, and, you know, he just told them, that store has porn magazines in it. It's bad for the kids, bad for other people, and I'm not going to shop there, and you shouldn't shop there anymore. Now, I don't remember exactly how much time went by, because this is now like, you know, 50 years ago that this happened. But my recollection is that within, I don't know, maybe a couple of months or something like that, the guy had gotten rid of the porn magazines. And he didn't do it because he, I don't think anyway, I'll never know, but my assumption is he didn't do it out of the kindness of his heart. He didn't do it because he had a come to Jesus moment and he realized he was doing a bad thing. The reason he did it is because people in great numbers stopped shopping there. So it was bad for business. He thought he would have a little extra cash flow coming in from the porn. Little did he realize that people like my dad were up in arms about that and they boycotted the place. So eventually he took all the porn magazines out because he wanted to stay in business. Money talks, young Cyrus. Never forget that. That's a lesson. You heard it here first. Money talks. And lack of money also talks too. I'll be right back.
Full stop.